You know, some of y'all are going to have husbands that come back from the men's retreat and won't really be able to do much because of all the aches and pains from their experience on the basketball court and other infantile type things that men do when they get away. I just want you to notice, just a little test, watch how that energy level increases around five-ish, you know, when the Super Bowl starts up and everything. Socrates, the great philosopher, once said that an unexamined life is not worth living. And I would suggest to you that I believe that in the world in which we live, that an unexamined faith is not worth believing. Do you really know what you believe? And do you really know what other people believe? Have you taken the time to stop and think it through? To examine it and evaluate it? Well, in light of September 11th, there have been lots and lots of questions about what different groups believe, and to think that people actually were motivated by a religious ideology to do the kind of horrific things that people did have caused people to question, well, what do people actually believe? And there have been a number of things that have sprung up. One of the more humorous and I think interesting things that I observed was on BeliefNet.com, they have a little inventory or survey called Belief-O-Matic. Some of you may have seen it advertised in The Statesman. Well, Belief-O-Matic is designed to help you understand what you believe. And here's what they say. Even if you don't know what faith you are, Belief-O-Matic knows. Answer 20 questions about your concept of God, the afterlife, human nature, and more, and Belief-O-Matic will tell you what religion, if any, you practice or ought to consider practicing. So you go in there and, you know, you answer the questions, and they've got these theological questions and life questions. You answer them, and then you rate the priority. Do you believe this is important or not so important or not important, low, high, low? And so you take this inventory, and then it tells you what your basic faith is. And fortunately, I took it. Because I was a little concerned, you know, maybe I was inconsistent in my faith. And whew, you know, after 8 years of theological training and a lot more years of study, I actually came out as a conservative Protestant. Can you imagine that? So I guess I'm okay there. You know, I was worried, you know, come out a Baha'i or something like that, I'd be in big trouble. I'd lose my job. Anyway, the most interesting thing on this BeliefNet survey is the disclaimer that they gave, and this is actually what's on the website. There's this warning. Belief-O-Matic assumes no legal liability for the ultimate fate of your soul. You know, that's if you sue in the life to come, they don't want to be responsible for those lawsuits. Interestingly enough, I think that lots of people are tapping in and trying to figure out what it is that I actually believe. And in the midst of the world in which we live, I would suggest to you that not to really know what you believe or not to know why you believe it, that's a huge mistake. Because as the disclaimer, the warning on Belief-O-Matic says, that the eternal destiny of your life, your afterlife really depends on what you embrace and what you believe. What's so astonishing to me is that in light of September 11th, there's one particular religious faith that I thought would be losing adherence. And you know what? The fastest growing religion in the United States today, is Islam. You know, they got a huge PR problem. But it doesn't seem to be stopping people from joining that religious faith. In fact, Chuck Colson writes an article on this, and he talks about Islam being the fastest growing religion in the United States, and that more than 30% of mosque attendees are new converts. They're not people that grew up in Islam. They're people that converted to Islam. And he suggests that oftentimes people really don't understand what it is that they're buying into or what they're believing. He says in his article, whatever the reason for Islam's gains, it's clear that Christians have their work cut out for them. We must educate ourselves so we can explain the differences between Islam and Christianity. New converts to Islam often display a faulty understanding of both faiths. For example, Lisa, one of the recent converts that they were interviewing, Lisa said, "I like the fact that to become a Muslim, you don't have to disrespect Jesus. He's still a prophet, just not the Son of God." Colson says, "She doesn't seem to realize that placing Muhammad above Christ is the ultimate in disrespect." You see, Christianity teaches that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He's exclusively the Son of God. And if he's any less than the Son of God, he's a total fraud. But somehow in her mind, she doesn't even understand that Christianity teaches that and thinks somehow that she can hold to Islam and Christianity at the same time and there's no conflict between the two. But to embrace the belief that Jesus Christ is not the Son of God is similar to me saying to my son, "You know, I'm sure glad you're in my family. You're on the same level as our dog." Say, well, you know, that's lowering him from humanity or from being a human being to being an animal. That's disrespect, right? Lowering Jesus Christ from being the Son of God to just another prophet is inconsistent with Christianity. And yet, so many people have not even examined the basis of what they believe or what they embrace that in many ways, people hold to a faith that isn't really even consistent within that own religion itself. And I would suggest to you that as we look at the world in which we live, we need to not only understand what we as Christians believe, but we also need to understand what other religions believe as well, and the validity and the lack of validity that's contained in each of these religions. And so we're starting a study where we're going to actually go through the major world religions. We're going to take a look at Islam, we're going to take a look at Hinduism, we're going to take a look at Buddhism, and we're going to take a look at nominal Christianity. Because those are the four major religions besides Christianity, as we understand it, biblical Christianity. And so we're going to be looking at that over the next few weeks. And as we dive into a discussion of this, we really are kind of on politically incorrect grounds. And the reason why is because the world in which we live, in America, we've been conditioned to think in terms of pluralism. That there's a little bit of good in all religions, that everybody's getting to the same place, they're just taking different roads, that, you know, we're all leading in the same direction, and really to try to define one religion as better than another, or one religion as true and another religion as false, that's bigotry and that's bad. In fact, there are many cults that have been springing up in the last few years, and a lot of them espouse these kinds of ideas. One of those cults is the cult Urantia, and in the Urantia book, it says these words. It says, "There are many religions of Urantia. All are good to the extent that they bring man to God and bring the realization of the Father to man. It is a fallacy for any group of religionists to conceive of their creed as the truth. Such attitudes bespeak more of theological arrogance than of certainty of faith." Oh, that's interesting. So basically what you're saying is if you don't believe that your religion is the truth, that somehow that makes you certain, versus those who believe that what they believe is the truth are somehow uncertain. Now, I don't know how that works, but it doesn't make sense to me. If you know your phone number for sure, are you not more certain of knowing your phone number for sure than if you don't know your phone number? But it's that kind of nonsensical mumbo-jumbo that litters the landscape of thinking today. Let me go on and read what else they say in this book. "There is not a Urantia religion that could not profitably study and assimilate the best of the truths contained in every other faith, for all contain truth. Religionists would do better to better to borrow the best in their neighbor's living spiritual faith rather than to denounce the worst in their lingering superstitions and outworn rituals." On the outside, that sounds really good, but I wonder what they would say to the nation of Israel back in the Old Testament days, living next to those who worshiped the god Molech, who believed that that god desired and required the sacrifice of children in order to appease that god. Do you take the best of that and start killing your kids? Or maybe all religious faiths aren't equally as good. When Cortez landed in Mexico and began to explore Mexico and Central America. And the Aztec Indians were regularly involved in human sacrifice. Should that have just been kind of incorporated into the faith that he brought? Are all religions the same? Is there truth in every one? You know, the people who say things like that probably have a very limited understanding of what world religions actually teach. Because when you begin to find what religions actually teach, you're going to find out that there are significant differences. And those differences are not compatible. What we're going to understand as we begin to look is that truth, by its very nature, is narrow. Truth, by its very nature, is narrow. Now let me explain to you how that works. Suppose that your child brought home a paper from school, you know, one of those take home, bring it home, fill in the blanks, you know, work it out problems. So let me give you an example of that. Suppose one of your kids brought home a math problem. And you've seen these before, right? You know, one turnip plus one turnip plus one turnip plus one turnip equals how many turnips? Okay, some of you are bold, brave. You think you've got the answer. Others are still pondering. Takes a while. It's Sunday. You don't think much on Sunday. So, okay. Four, right? Now, suppose that young junior brought this take-home paper home and he'd put in the answer five and his teacher marked it incorrect and he brought it home. What do you say to junior? You say, "Junior, that teacher is so narrow. I just can't believe it. I mean, there are many right answers to this problem. Using your creative mind, if you came up with five, that's okay. Five is fine. There's nothing wrong with a five." You see, here's what I'm trying to help you understand. Truth, by its very nature, is narrow. Now, error, by its very nature, boy, there's lots of options. You know, you could say one, you could say two, you could say three, you could say five, you could say 792 minus 12. Those are all options, but they're all wrong. Truth by its very nature is narrow. Let's try another one. This one's a little more complicated. One horse plus one horse minus one horse equals one. Now, there are a lot of wrong answers. But the common denominator between every other answer besides one is that it is wrong. Do you understand what I'm saying? Truth, by its very nature, is narrow. Error, by its very nature, is broad. So to be right is to be narrow. To be wrong, I mean, you could be wrong in a myriad of different ways. Let me take some other examples that, you know, we're real comfortable with. Water. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. We're pretty comfortable with that. And water also freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So when the weatherman comes on and says, it's going to freeze tonight, we're going to have freezing temperatures, it's going to get below 32 degrees tonight, we understand what that means. If the weatherman came on and said, you know, for those of you who are not interested in an exact number, 32, for those of you who really believe that water really freezes at minus 27, don't worry about it tonight. You know, don't cover your plants, don't let your faucet drip, don't worry, because in your mind, you know, if water freezes at minus 27, you're not going to have a problem. But now for the rest of you who believe that water freezes at 32, you might want to go ahead and let the faucet drip. Do you understand what I'm saying? We understand truth. We understand that it's narrow. We understand that the earth is round. Even though there's a flat earth society and people still hold to a flat earth. We understand that. That's not a problem for us. We understand gravity. When the apple leaves the tree, which direction is it going to fall? Down. Truth, by its very nature, is narrow. And even a child can understand that concept. Right? It's not hard to understand. You don't have to have a PhD to understand it. Or if you park your car under a building that's being constructed, like the guy in Washington, D.C. did, and they let go of one of the girders, guess which direction it's going to fall? You know, unfortunately, if you're in a construction company and you lose a girder from the 11th floor and it lands on the car of an attorney, there's absolute truth in that. You're going to get sued. You see, the world is clear. We operate on that basis. It's not that hard. When we look at reality, when we're looking for truth, explanations of reality, we find that there's a right answer. And that right answer is truth. And the truth is narrow. There are a lot of wrong answers, but there's a right answer. That's what we call truth. I love what G.K. Chesterton said. Chesterton said, the modern habit of saying, "This is my opinion, but I may be wrong," is entirely irrational. If I say that it may be wrong, I say that it is not my opinion. I mean, think about it. This is my opinion, but it may be wrong. Well, that's stupid. Well, why would anybody hold to a wrong opinion? You must think it's right, or you wouldn't hold to it, right? Or say, this is an idea that people hold to. Don't take credit for it. He goes on to say, the modern habit of saying, every man has a different philosophy. This is my philosophy and it suits me. The habit of saying this is mere weak-mindedness. It means I haven't thought it through. I haven't invested the time. I haven't put the energy into it. You know, if this is my personal philosophy, and I it's my opinion, and I really haven't settled it as true or not true, then I'm just not working very hard. And he goes on to say something that's profound. He says this. He says, a cosmic philosophy is not constructed to fit a man. A cosmic philosophy is constructed to fit a cosmos. A man can no more possess a private religion than he can possess a private sun and moon. Either what you believe describes reality. Either it fits with the world, either it fits with nature, either it fits with humanity, either it fits with who God is, or you're wrong. So the concept of, well, your beliefs are fine for you and my beliefs are fine for me, and we can have different beliefs and we can both be right, even though they contradict each other, that doesn't make any sense. Can we both be right about the boiling point of water? You say, well, yeah, you live in Denver and I live here and I know all that, and if you're smart enough to kind of have thought that through, and you think you got me on that one, we all understand, don't we, the altitude issue? That's a changing of the factors. In this situation, when everything's equal, if you believe something different than I do, and we're both in disagreement, one of them is true, one of them describes reality, one of them is not. That's reality. Now let me make a distinction for you, because it's very important. Oftentimes we get confused between being narrow, which is what truth is, and being narrow-minded. And there's a big difference between the two. Being narrow is simply embracing truth. So like my phone number is 258-9865. You say, well, I like ones. Why are you so narrow not to have any ones in your phone number? If you don't have any ones in your phone number, I'm just going to keep trying ones when I call you, because that's where I'm coming from. I like ones. It's not going to work. We know that. Narrow is establishing what's accurate, what's true, what's right. Narrow-mindedness is the attitude where I'm not willing to examine evidence. You see the difference? Narrow is when I focus on truth. Narrow-mindedness is when I say, well, what I believe, I'm not willing to consider any other evidence to the contrary. Now, that's narrow-mindedness. I see that attitude displayed in places where narrow-mindedness is not considered acceptable. For example, when I brought my daughter's ninth grade biology book, when she brought it home and I read the chapter on origins, and I looked through that and they gave the seven proofs of evolution, same ones that I got taught when I was in school, that you got taught when you were in school. You know what? In the last 25 years, every single one of those examples is considered unscientific today. They're considered unscientific, but they're still printed in the textbook and they're used in the school. Now, if I were to say to the administration, look, what you're publishing here, what you're printing, what you're teaching here, all of the best biological minds in the world no longer believe this stuff. And they refuse to examine the evidence and say, you know, you're right. That experiment, that didn't prove what we thought it proved. We need to take that. To not do that would be narrow-minded, not to be willing to examine the evidence. So a narrow-minded person says, I know what I think, and I don't care what evidence there is. A narrow person is simply someone who focuses on truth and is willing to look at evidence as it comes along. So truth, by its very nature, is narrow, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm glad that truth is narrow. Otherwise, it would be an awful confusing world. Now, in the face of all that, we have to ask and answer the question, what about Christianity? Because when we come to Christianity, we're going to find that Jesus Christ says Christianity is truth, and He explains it as being narrow. I want you to open your Bibles to the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. In Matthew chapter 7, Jesus is speaking. This is the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, this is His big message. Message that, you know, almost everybody will go to and say, boy, that's the greatest message ever preached. This is where you can find truth. Man, if everybody just lived by the Sermon on the Mount, that's the place. Now, I want you to see what's actually in the Sermon on the Mount, because a lot of people who say that don't even know what's in the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 7, starting in verse 13, Jesus speaking, it says, enter through the what? The narrow gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the road that leads to destruction. And many enter through it, but small is the gate, and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Jesus says that there's a right gate, and we must enter by the narrow gate. If you want to come to God, if you want to come to the Father, if you want to have a connection with God, if you want to get into heaven, there is a gate, it's narrow, and it leads to life. But there's also a broad path. Many travel it. Many are going in that direction. And guess where it leads? What does Jesus say? It leads to what? It leads to destruction. So it's an exclusive message that Jesus is laying out here. That exclusivity is not uncommon in the words of God. In fact, if you go all the way back to the Old Testament and look at what God said about Himself, the very words of God, I want you to see what He said. In a world of pluralism, God says, Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Now, He was saying that in the polytheistic culture, where the Egyptians had their myriads of gods, and the Assyrians had their myriads of gods, and the Canaanites had their myriads of gods. And God says, listen, Israel, you need to understand that there is only one God, and I'm it. Now, can you get any more narrow than that? That's a pretty narrow message in the midst of that culture. Later on in the Ten Commandments, in Exodus chapter 20, verse 3, the first commandment is, you shall have no other gods before me. That's a pretty straightforward statement, isn't it? The narrowness of what God has to say. I'm the only one. Don't have any others because I'm the only one. In the New Testament, Jesus, speaking of Himself in John 14, 6, Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, Jesus is making an exclusive statement. If you're going to trust in me, you're going to trust in me alone, that's the only way to get to heaven. The only way to come to the Father is through Jesus Christ. Now, this is what Jesus is saying. Later on in Acts chapter 4, verse 12, salvation is found in no one else, for there is none other name, no other name under heaven given to men by which we must be saved. Now, I want to pause and point out something that may be obvious to you, but it's important. This is not the statement of Hill Country Bible Church. This is not the statement of an arrogant preacher, Tim Hawks. I'm not saying this. These are the words of the Bible. These are the words of Jesus Himself. It's not me. You know, you've all seen those talk shows where the host has got the Christian backed into a corner and says, do you believe? Who cares what he believes? The question is, what does Jesus say? What does the Bible say? And the Bible says that truth is narrow and the only way to God, according to Jesus Christ, is through Him. Narrow is the gate. Well, why is it that so many people get off track? Why is it that so many people are on the wrong paths? Why is it so many people are trying other ways to get to God? Well, he gives us the answer in the next few verses in Matthew chapter 7, where he goes on to talk about avoiding the wrong guide. He says in verse 15, "Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing." In other words, they look correct on the outside, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. "By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit you will recognize them." So in other words, at the entrance to the broad way that leads to destruction, there are many false prophets who look on the outside. They look good. They got sheep's clothing, but inside they're wolves. And they're saying, "Come this way, come this way, come this way, come this way." And people are following them. Well, how do we keep from following the wrong one? He says, well, look at their fruit. Look at their fruit. If you look at their fruit, you can tell that they're false. Now, oftentimes we interpret this to mean, look at their produce or their lifestyle or what comes out of what they teach. In other words, if what they ultimately are doing is bad and evil, then avoid them. But if they're doing good things, if making good things happen, then that must be good fruit. And that's what he's talking about. You know what? If you evaluate it on the basis of what you observe on the outside, if that's your understanding of this passage, then I've got a really good offer for you. In fact, let me just describe it to you, because there's a church that the pastor... Well, let me just tell you a little bit about him. He's committed to people in need. Counsel prisoners, juvenile delinquents. He started a job placement center. He opened rest homes and homes for the retarded. He had a health clinic. He organized a vocational training center. He provided free legal aid. He founded a community center. He preached about God. He claimed to cast out demons and do miracles and heal. In addition to that, he gained the admiration and the praises of countless church leaders, governors, senators, congressmen, and even the President of the United States. Boy, that looks good, doesn't it? So you want to join his church? If you do, you just joined Jim Jones and the People's Temple. Do you think all those people went to Ghana with him and committed suicide with him because all they ever saw to him was bad, wicked, evil, ugly? They got involved because he did a lot of good things. Now, this passage is not telling us that fruit means works or deeds. In fact, it means something entirely different. If you'll turn over to chapter 12, where Jesus is talking to false teachers, the Pharisees, in verse 33, he uses the same analogy. Matthew chapter 12, verse 33. He says, "Make a tree good and its fruit will be good, or make a tree bad and its fruit will be bad. For a tree is recognized by its fruit." Now, wouldn't you agree that we're talking about the same analogy here? It's the same context. He goes on to say, "You brood of vipers, how can you who are evil..." What's the next word? "How can you who are evil say anything good? For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good man brings good things out of the good stored up in him, and the evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in him. But I tell you that men will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken. For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned." What's he saying? He's saying, watch out for false prophets, because what comes out of their mouth is not true. Their teaching is false. You can be deceived by their lifestyle. You can look at what they're doing charitably to help other people. A lot of people look at religion and they say, well, that religion's done a lot of good for a lot of people. That's not the way you evaluate it. The question is it true? Does it correspond with truth? Does it fit the nature of the world and humanity and God? Is it really an accurate picture of truth? If it's not, we reject it no matter what kind of good it may appear to be doing. In fact, good people with wrong philosophy or helpful people with wrong philosophy are as dangerous as people who are bad with wrong philosophy. Because if you embrace lies and error, you will ultimately end in lies and error. And that's where Jim Jones and his people ended up in the end. It's what they say, what's coming out of their mouth. Are they speaking truth or are they speaking falsehood? From this point, Jesus goes on in Matthew chapter 7. I want you to jump back over there. And he summarizes what he's been saying with a very, very sobering account of the future. He says in verse 21, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." Verse 22, "Many will say to me on that day." Now, what day is he talking about? He's talking about the judgment. When a person stands in the presence of God at the end, he says, "Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?'" Notice that all of these activities are religious in nature. So these people are religious people. Prophecy, miracles, perform miracles. These are religious people who are standing in the presence of Jesus Christ, calling him Lord, Lord, on the final judgment. And notice what he says to them. This is powerful. He says, "Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers." Whoa, that's pretty strong. He's saying that there will be religious people, people who claim to have done great things in the name of a God, who will stand in the presence of God, Jesus Christ, on that day, and he'll say, "You're not mine. I didn't know you. You didn't come through me." To answer the question, do all paths lead to the same place? Jesus anticipated that question, which, by the way, didn't just first get asked in our century. Jesus anticipated that question and answered it by saying, no, all paths don't lead to the same place. There's only one path. It's through Jesus Christ, and that's the only way to God. Now, that's narrow, right? But if it's true, then it's right. Christianity claims to have the only way to God. By the way, as we look at some of these other religions, contrary to the popular mythology, they also claim to have the only way to God. And we'll see that when we begin to look at them. You'll begin to see that it's completely incompatible, that you can't hold to both of them at the same time, though some sloppy thinkers try to do that. You can't do it. Christianity is claiming to be the exclusive way to God. Now, in the face of all that, the challenge to us as people, not as Christians, but as people, challenge to us as people, is that we must engage in the noble pursuit of truth. That's our responsibility. I mean, if we want to have truth, we've got to seek it. We've got to engage in it. We've got to go after it. And finding truth is not just an option. It's essential. If you want to embrace truth, if you want to know that you have a relationship with God, if you want to connect with the ultimate issues of the world, you've got to be on an unequivocal search for truth. You've got to engage in finding truth and embracing truth and holding on to it. You can't just say, well, it'll all sort itself out in the end. That's a belief not worth holding to. That's a dangerous place to be. There are exclusive statements made by all these religions, and Jesus Christ makes it. Either Jesus Christ is the truth or he's not. And if Jesus Christ is the truth, he's the only way to God. And we need to engage in this pursuit of truth. It's a noble pursuit. Unfortunately, there are many people who've lived who've been very intelligent people who completely miss the mark when it comes to a pursuit of truth. I want to share with you a statement made by one of the world's most brilliant men, Albert Einstein. Listen to what he says and listen to what he bases it on. He says, "I cannot conceive of a God who rewards and punishes his creatures or has a will of the type which we are conscious in ourselves." Now, what's his proof for that? He said, "I cannot conceive." Oh, so basically, you sat down one day and you made up your mind as to what God should be like and what God shouldn't be like. And any God that doesn't fit what you think a God should be like, you're going to throw out. Now, if the rest of us decided to do our mathematical calculations on that, if we decided to do our engineering on the basis of that, if we decided to build bridges on the basis of that, if we decided to handle our finances, well, I guess we saw some of that in Houston, didn't we? On the basis of that, what happens? It doesn't work, does it? You can't just conceive or not conceive. And I guess I have a question for Mr. Einstein. What do you do with Adolf Hitler? If you have a God that doesn't punish, what do you do with Adolf Hitler? If you have a God that doesn't reward, what do you do with Mother Teresa? You see, that's just bad thinking. He goes on to say, an individual who should survive his physical death is also beyond my comprehension. It's hard for me to imagine life after death. And so he calls these notions our fears for or absurd egotism of feeble souls. In other words, if you don't conceive of life based on your opinion of your subjective thinking the way I do, then you're a feeble soul or you're egotistical. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that by pseudo-intelligent people. And when I say pseudo, that doesn't refer to their brain capacity. That refers to their willingness to seek and find truth. It's not just an option, it's essential. Secondly, teaching truth is critical, not just considerate. It's not just helpful. It's not just nice. It's not just kind to teach truth. It's something that is required of us. As we seek and find truth, as we seek and find God, as we seek and find Jesus Christ in Christianity, sharing the gospel with someone else, passing that along to them so that they can understand how to come to God, that's not just something that's a nice thing to do. That's something that's absolutely critical, something that we must be involved in. You see, after spending years of my life in a pursuit of truth, after spending years of my life reading and studying, I am absolutely convinced that Christianity is credible. I'm convinced that historically it's reliable, that the things of the Bible are true. They've been proven over and over again. I'm absolutely convinced that Christianity explains the world in which we live. It makes sense of human nature. I'm absolutely convinced that Jesus Christ lived, that He said what's recorded in the Bible, that He died on the cross and He rose from the grave. There's historical evidence to validate that. In addition to that, I'm absolutely convinced that I have a living relationship with Jesus Christ based on my own personal experience with Him. He's changed my life. And I believe with all my heart that Christianity is true. And I also believe with all my mind that Christianity is true. And if you believe that too, who are you talking to about this? Are you telling it to other people? Are you sharing with them what you've learned? Let me share one story with you before I close. A story I've shared with many of you before, but it just rocks my soul. So I'm going to share it with you again. A friend of mine and his buddy were together riding in the truck on their way to the hunting camp, and they were talking about Christianity. The third friend in the car who was driving was an avowed agnostic. He'd grown up with a Christian background, but because of his lifestyle and the things that he wanted to pursue, he'd rejected it and walked away. And these three guys had been buddies for years and years and years, and they'd talked to the driver of the car on several occasions, but he just would have nothing to do with Christianity. He just couldn't embrace it, didn't believe it, didn't want to have anything to do with it. So they're talking, and he's listening in, and they thought he was ignoring them. But finally, as they're driving down the dark road on the way to the hunting camp, he turns to them and says, "Do you guys really believe this stuff, this Christianity stuff?" And of course, my friend said, "Yeah, we believe it." He says, "Do you really believe that people who don't accept Jesus Christ are going to hell?" My friend said, "Well, you know, that's what Jesus said, so yeah, I believe it." He said, "You know what? I don't believe that, but if I did, I would be in the darkest, deepest jungles of the Amazon right now, telling every single person that I could get face to face with that they needed to find Jesus Christ so that they could go to heaven. If I believed what you believe, I would not be in this truck going to the hunting camp. I would be out telling every single person that I could encounter how they could go to heaven." And my friend was stunned. Because if it's really true, which it is, why would we be so passive? Letting this so-called pluralistic culture call us narrow-minded when we have the truth that can give them life? You see, sharing truth is not just considerate. It is something that's absolutely critical to the eternal destinies of men and women and children. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that you are the kind of God who doesn't stutter. You're the kind of God who makes it clear. And we really rest in the absolute freedom that comes from not having to guess which path to choose, but having the clear revelation of your word. Father, give us the courage to be truth seekers, to examine the evidence of our faith and embrace it totally and share it with others. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.